You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello, and welcome to The Dirt, a podcast about archaeology, anthropology, and our shared human past. I'm Anna.
And I'm Amber. And let us shout out some new patrons. Kenneth and Audrey, who were patrons before, but upgraded to the Dirt After Dark tier. And Brianna, thank you so much for supporting the show, all of you.
Thank you.
And we hope that y'all enjoy the bonus content.
Yes, indeed. And one more bit of business before we get going. Some folks reached out very kindly about some of the Malagasy pronunciations from our Madagascar episode. So what we pronounced as Marina should have been more like Marine. And the word for a group of people that I pronounced as Fokonolona should have been more like Fokonwon. I hope I did that correctly. Or closer to correctly. And I really appreciate the corrections. And Glenn even told us in the original email that Malagasy was phonetic, except when it wasn't. So I found some places where it isn't. And I hope I did better on this attempt.
Okay. Yeah. We got so much great mail about our Madagascar episode.
We did. And it was wonderful.
I think that other people are as excited as we are to talk and think about Madagascar. And so we'll be doing that in the future.
We will. We will absolutely go back there. And so this week marks our 130th episode, which in pod years makes us teenagers.
Oh.
Pretty sure that's how that works. Or we saw a number that was a multiple of 13 and came up with a funny title before the topic. And so welcome to our pod mitzvah.
So we're following our episode on children and childhood in the ancient past with one dealing with how people in different places and times marked the transition into adulthood. It'll be a mixed bag of ritual, tradition, and probably some puberty flashbacks. Yikes. We're flash forwards.
Fun for everyone. Yeah. Oh, well.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry in advance.
Yep. So this is part two of the child development adjacent episode sponsored by my mom. Thanks, Mom. So hopefully it makes for some good teaching material and some good listening material for those of you who aren't currently studying psychology. Let's start by talking more broadly about what it might mean to become an adult, and then we can get to some specific examples.
Oh, okay. I get it. This is when I went to the changing program with all the other girls in my class, right?
Oh, no.
In fifth grade.
I just remember them.
Kenny in my class that like asked our teacher, like, are we gonna learn about bees humps? No, Kenny.
Like, he had conflated the birds and the bees with health class, and he was just really mad about the fact that he might learn about bee reproduction. I hope it's different from that. And I also hope it's different from my fifth grade experience where my health teacher didn't know how to spell larynx. And I was concerned. Wonder how she's doing. Anyway, so I thought we'd talk about how the criteria for becoming an adult are going to be culturally dependent, because that's a theme that we hit on in the previous episode. And it comes around again here. So if we start with the broadly American background that you and I both share, Amber, I've got this abstract from Jeffrey Jensen Arnett, who is currently a professor in the Department of Psychology at Clark University in Massachusetts. And so he coined the term emerging adulthood, which refers to the distinct phase between adolescence and young adulthood occurring from the ages of 18 to 25. And that was interesting to me, since when we talked about doing this topic, I had a different concept of the transitional age in mind. In my head, it was a bit earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So there are different kind of types of criteria that we could discuss for becoming an adult, sort of in our framework. So like legal, behavioral, anatomical. So what would you say, when would you say a person becomes an adult, Amber?
I think if we're talking about sort of a, like present day American society, so that's the only one that I really have much to do with, like in my past, at least.
Yeah.
You become an adult when you reach the legal age of majority, unless you do something bad in the eyes of the law. So like there are people, it's really, I think it's through like the lens of the law. So, you know, like if young people, like people younger than 18 commit crimes that are seen as bad, that are seen as like especially heinous, then they're adults sooner.
Yeah.
And like if they're
according
like,
to the law,
according to the law and by extension, I think society. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that if there are people that are seen as, I don't know, incapable of bad, like perhaps somebody with like an intellectual disability or, you know, something that like they're seen as children longer, like they aren't really treated or read as adults. And I think that this is also sort of like racialized and perhaps might also fall along like class lines, that there are people that don't get to be children as long, and there are people that are treated as children well into adulthood. And I think there's sort of like race and gender factors into that.
Yeah, that's the thing. There are all kinds of intersecting factors that influence societal perception of when that transition to adulthood occurs. So this is from a psychological perspective, Arnett, he's a psychologist. So
thinking about like when their brains are adult.
Well, that's the thing. This paper that we're pulling from here is a survey of college students and then slightly older, what we would say is adults, but this is like sort
traditional
of
aged college students,
traditionally aged college students, and then also a slightly older age bracket. And so this is self-reported criteria for adulthood. So Arnett writes, conceptions of the transition to adulthood were examined using data from 346 college students aged 18 to 23 and 140 21 to 28 year olds. So that's the slightly older age bracket, which is not to say that you can't be in college from ages 21 to 28. Right. Participants indicated the characteristics necessary for a person to be considered an adult on a questionnaire containing 40 possible criteria. In both studies, as in both age groups, the top criteria endorsed emphasized aspects of individualism, including accept responsibility for the consequences of your actions, decide on own beliefs and values independently of parents or other influences, and establish a relationship with parents as an equal adult. When does that happen? In contrast, role transitions typically associated with research on the transition to adulthood, such as finishing education, entering the labor force, marriage, and parenthood, were rejected as criteria for adulthood by a large majority in both studies. The results suggest that the current generation of young people in American society conceptualizes the transition to adulthood in intangible, gradual, psychological, and individualistic terms. And granted, this study was from, I believe, the late 90s, but it's still, I imagine that these trends are ongoing. I wasn't able to find any sort of later studies following up on this. So if we take Arnett's perspective, achieving adulthood, again, specifically for Americans and presumably for Americans of a specific social class, because of how this study was conducted, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, yeah.
I mean, has much less.
That's sort of like what it's representative of. Like and it probably would be irresponsible for us to sort of extrapolate.
To
populations with very different lived experiences. But
yeah. So for this particular sliver of lived experience, achieving adulthood has much less to do with checking off kind of game of life related boxes like marriage or employment, and much more to do with highly individualistic or behavioral shifts. So as one more thought exercise before we get into some cultural and historical examples, I want to brainstorm some events or criteria with you that might signal a person's coming of age. I sort of wanted to see if there's a common age when these things typically occur or if it's spread out over a longer span. So I looked into this, and this sort of turned into something different than what I was originally planning for the script. I went off down a rabbit hole, but I was looking at anatomical or physiological changes having to do with transition to adulthood, and so specifically puberty. So for biological females, physical traits to do with puberty have to do with the onset of menstruation, which the first period is called menarche, or is it menarche? I don't know.
I think it's menarche.
Menarche. I said that with such confidence.
I think the end of it is an eta.
Menarche. I'm going to just pronounce it my default French. Yes.
The equivalent in biological males is spermarchy.
Is it?
Yeah.
Huh.
I just learned that the other day because I was working on the Dirt After Dark script and I was just like,
oh boy. Well, that's a treat for me for later, I guess.
No, we're not talking too much about sperm.
Okay, that's great.
Or are we?
I don't know. So I learned a few things about our bodies ourselves. There is no specific hormonal trigger known for the onset of menstruation, but it is linked to attaining a certain percent body fat, which is around 17%. Mm. So, you know, kids typically don't have a lot of body fat because they're growing. Their body is using that fat for fuel. And this is one of the reasons why a lot of really hardcore athletes, like young athletes and especially dancers, for example, often will have delayed onset of menstruation because they haven't reached that percent of body fat. So the normal range of occurrence.
And it's also the same thing for communities in which children participate in sort of like physical labor. Mm-hmm. And like if like whether it's agricultural labor or, you know, any kind of like strenuous labor that.
Yeah, same idea.
Like would keep their weight down. Like it would just mm-hmm. sort of the and it's
any a lot of exertion. Any circumstance that keeps body fat below that sort of onset level is going to most likely result in delayed onset of menarche. The normal range of occurrence for the start of menstruation is between ages 9 and 16, although that is dependent on many, many external factors. So again, lots of stuff going on that is not as well understood as I thought it might be. I'm not a medical doctor, despite our text chain. I don't know why it hurts, Amber. Stop poking it. On the other side of things, there is puberty for young biological males. And one of those things is the voice deepening. So this was really interesting. I had no idea how this worked. And so I looked it up and now I know how it works. And then I'm going to tell you about how the ancient Greeks thought it worked. And it's very funny.
There's an owl in there and the owl turns its head. And as it turns its head, it winds your vocal cords.
It's almost as silly as that. The vocal cords, also known as vocal folds. So for the record, this is the correct thing that I'm telling you now.
Okay.
are dual strips of cartilage and other tissues in the voice box, which is also called your larynx or larynx. The vocal folds vibrate to produce basic sounds. So my health teacher thought it was larynx. It's not. It's larynx.
It's not larynx, is it?
It's not. Nope. The vocal folds vibrate to produce the basic sounds, and then you modify these sounds with your mouth and sort of your tongue and etc. to make words. The longer and thicker the vocal cords, the lower pitched the sounds.
So words start at puberty?
Yeah, you can't make words until... No, it went on... Well, you could just go and not make words, but your vocal cords would still be affected by puberty if you were biologically male and only went So at birth, boys and girls' vocal folds are similar lengths, measuring about 2 millimeters long, so small, but they continue to grow as the child grows. And so for girls, the vocal folds grow 0.4 millimeters in length each year, but boys' vocal folds grow 0.7 millimeters in length for the same period, almost twice as much. So by the time boys start to reach maturity, their voice starts to get deeper because those vocal folds are still growing, whereas for girls, they're not growing quite as fast.
Okay, so it isn't something that happens.
I think it's related to major growth spurts, like what you start to get in puberty where things just start growing really fast.
And so
your bones hurt.
Okay. So the so it's not like someone's voice cracks and that's like it happening.
I actually don't know why. I think the voice cracking just has to do with like adjustment to the growth of the vocal cords. Okay. I mean, my understanding of this was also limited.
We can both tell that the changing program like didn't take for me. Like,
and so okay, reading about this rang a tiny little bell way back in my in my brain, and I
somebody's
remembered
watched
something. And so I remembered something that I did in fact see on QI, and it was a study that won the Ig Nobel Prize. I think back in the early 2000s or 90s. And so this was research done by Ian McManus. And so it was basically his research specifically was on the depiction of the scrotum in Greek classical and pre-classical art. So, well, let me just read the abstract to his paper presenting this research, and we can take it from there. The scrotum in humans is asymmetric, the right testicle being visibly higher than the left in most men. Paradoxically, it is also the case that the right testicle is somewhat larger rather than smaller, as might be expected. So I guess placement isn't dependent on gravity. Greek classical and pre-classical art, which took great care in its attention to anatomical detail, correctly portrayed the right testicle as higher, but then incorrectly portrayed the left testicle as visibly larger. The implication is that the Greeks used a simple mechanical theory, the left testicle being thought to be lower because it was larger and hence more subject to the pull of gravity. So in my own words, the theory also extended to the effect on the male voice, literally suggesting that the vocal cords and testicles were connected, suggesting that as the testicles grew, especially that heavy left one, their pull on the vocal cord increased, lengthening the cord and deepening the voice. And that was written about like that. I think some Greek like wrote to that effect and was like, yes, this is how this works. So that I just enjoyed remembering that and wanted to share with everyone.
I do think I would prefer if it were an owl.
Clarification, is the owl in the voice box or in the scrotum?
I was just thinking like sort of mid tummy.
Okay.
Somewhere in like wherever our uterus goes when we
putting
like
the
do
man
work.
In menagerie.
Like when we like do work or think about math or something like in our uterus.
And our uterus starts to wander. Not everyone is going to know about that. So now we have to clarify.
So
the word hysteria and the word uterus are connected. Well, I mean, like Greeks and medieval people. And
no, but somebody wrote about that. Like I read it. Was it Galen?
I know. I think it was Galen. That sounds like him. Yeah. So the womb was prone to excitement and like a small animal would often wander about the female body. Spurred on by various things like too much excitement or...
Was it Plato? Well,
Galen
definitely, because Galen wrote about gynecology.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Plato and it was discussed by Soranus.
Yeah, your friend and mine, medical doctor Soranus.
Eretheus and then Galen.
Okay, well, a distinguished pedigree, but...
Also, just real quick sidebar. People also ask, does the uterus suffocate itself?
When? How? What? No. Short answer, no. Everyone on Google. I'm not a medical doctor, again, but no.
I don't know. Okay. Hippocrates would like to disagree with you.
Oh, he's dead. Well, let's move on, huh?
You brought it up.
I did. And I regret it. So let's move on to a different part of the body altogether.
There's another significant body change that happens over a much longer period of the average human's life, from around age 6 to age 12 or 13, and that is losing your twofers.
Yeah, losing your baby teeth. Do you remember that period? Do you remember? Do you have specific tooth-losing memories?
I have a few.
Did you ever do the thing with the string in the door?
Yeah, it didn't work.
Okay. Just ripped off the doorknob.
No, also I was like, I went to throw and then I was like, push.
It's just gonna hurt. No.
Well, as anybody who may have seen the photo of me and my mom on a boat.
Oh, so cute.
I didn't lose my front teeth at the same time. It was like a couple years. And so I had like, I had sort of like goofy teeth. But yeah, I remember losing my teeth. I remember we did like a little craftivity and, I think I lost my first one in kindergarten. And I was it's like so right excited age. To have gotten on the board because there was like a
point on the tooth. Board.
Yeah, I had a point on the board. Yeah. And I also have a very distinct memory of finding my baby teeth later.
Your mom kept them?
My dad kept them. My dad's a tooth keeper. He's also kept their dog's baby teeth.
Which is sort of sweet, but also.
They're all down in the gun safe. So just like keeping our teeth.
Okay. Well,
But I wasn't, I didn't get like fair market value for my teeth from the tooth fairy. And the tooth fairy is just something that.
We're going to get into that.
What's up with that?
Well, let's find out. Yeah, I just remember getting yelled at a lot because I would not stop wiggling my teeth.
Oh,
like when once they got a little bit loose.
Yeah.
My finger was always up in there and I got yelled at, but just like, stop. Get your finger out of your mouth.
It freaked me out to a degree that like I still have dreams about losing my teeth. It's like a regular thing for me.
It's a really common anxiety dream.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also have constant teeth dreams. Anyway.
In Northern Europe, there was a tradition of Tandfe or tooth fee, which was paid when a child lost their first tooth. This tradition is recorded in writings as early as the Eddas, which are around 1200 CE, which are the earliest written record of Norse and Northern European traditions. So see Thanks Viking from 2020. Mm-hmm. In the Norse culture, children's teeth and other articles belonging to children were said to bring good luck in battle, and Scandinavian warriors hung children's teeth on a string around their necks.
I think this is more likely like in a pouch around their necks. Cause I was trying to think, cause when you were, that's the thing. When you're a child and you lose teeth, it's because the roots have dissolved. Like the roots essentially sort of resorb back into your bone. And so I don't know, maybe you can get a hole through that tiny little nubbin of tooth, but probably so it's
like a little bead.
Either it was a little bead. I wasn't clear from this article, but either a little bead or in a pouch of some sort. But yeah.
Man, that is like equal parts cute, like sweet.
Yeah.
And so creepy.
Don't tell your dad. He'll do it.
Little nugget teeth.
He put Lexi's little tiny dog toofers bag around his neck.
During the Middle Ages, other superstitions arose surrounding children's teeth. In England, for example, children were instructed to burn their baby teeth in order to save the child from hardship in the afterlife. Children who did not consign their baby teeth to the flames would spend eternity searching for them in the afterlife.
Where's my teeth? Surely child ghosts have better things to do.
Fear of witches was another reason to bury or burn teeth. In medieval Europe, it was thought that if a witch were to get a hold of one's teeth, it could lead them to having total power over them.
Yeah, the idea of sympathetic magic, where if you have like a piece of something, you can affect harm or good on the larger something.
The modern incarnation of these traditions to an actual tooth fairy has been traced to a 1908 household hints item in the Chicago Daily Tribune, which says, many a refractory child will allow a loose tooth to be removed if he knows about the tooth fairy. If he takes his little tooth and puts it under the pillow when he goes to bed, the tooth fairy will come in the night and take it away, and in its place will leave some little gift. It's a nice plan for mothers to visit the 5-cent counter and lay in a supply of articles to be used on such occasions.
That's what the tooth fairy always did for me. I always got, you know, small items or books, but usually in a scavenger hunt, because I think my parents knew that if it was much easier to hide a note under my pillow than something bulky like a book, you know, the note would lead somewhere.
So the tooth fairy just like played games with you?
Yeah.
Was it a little ransom?
The tooth fairy played mind games. Yeah. If you want your present. No, it was usually very sweet.
Mr. Tooth Fairy, I gave you all the clues. There are some other tooth takers out there. There's the Ratoncito Perez, or Perez Mouse. And it is a figure similar, which I glazed over, figure skater. And I was like, oh.
A little figure skating mouse.
Is a figure similar to the Tooth Fairy, originating in Madrid in 1894. As is traditional in some English-speaking countries, when a child loses a tooth, it is customary for them to place it under the pillow so that Ratoncito Perez will exchange it for a gift. In Italy, the Tooth Fairy, the Fatina del Denti, is often replaced by a small mouse named Topolino.
This is about to get much less cute.
I saw her name and I was like, no. In some areas, it's the same role is held by Saint Apollonia, known as Santa Apollonia in Veneto. So it's because Saint Apollonia's legendary martyrdom involved having her teeth broken. So she's frequently depicted artistically holding a tooth and is considered the patron saint of dentistry and those with toothache and dental problems.
They managed to
do one as sort of like a, we're going to do this representative and not just like, oh, here's me wearing my skin as a cloak over my arm because I was afflayed.
Yeah. Like that's- and you wouldn't believe. So I was looking up I wanted information on tooth fairy-esque traditions. You would not believe how many of these things are hosted by dental practices. Nearly all of them. Nearly all of these facts were found first until I traced them back and found legit sources.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I just didn't realize that they were so, you know, lore-based.
In France and French-speaking Belgium, this character is called La Petite Souris. The little mouse. Little mouse.
The mouse. Oh,
From parts of lowland Scotland comes a tradition similar to the fairy mouse, a white fairy rat who purchases children's teeth with coins. Which, what's a fairy
rat? Let me have your teeth. Scottish accent needs work.
In Catalonia, it's a Scottish fae rat accent. It works.
Squeak, squeaking.
In Catalonia, the most popular would be Els Anglets and also Les Animetes, little souls. Mm-hmm. And as in the other countries, the tooth is placed under the pillow in exchange for a coin or a little token. In Japan, a different variation calls for lost upper teeth to be thrown straight down to the ground and lower teeth straight up into the air. The idea is that incoming teeth will grow in straight, I guess.
Well, you teach the lower teeth, like, go up.
Like this.
Yeah, and upper teeth go down.
In South Korea, the common practice is to throw both upper and lower teeth on the roof. The practice is rooted around the Korean national bird, the magpie. It is said that if the magpie finds a tooth on the roof, it will bring good luck or a gift. Some scholars think the myth derived from a Middle Korean word for magpies that sounds similar to new teeth. Or because in Korean.
Not in English.
Gosh, that's some like Zachariah Sitchin level like philology of being like, this word sounds like new teeth. That works. That's like,
got it.
That's not what it is in this language. Or because in Korean mythology, magpies were thought to be messengers between gods and humans. So in countries including what is today Iraq, Jordan, Egypt, and Sudan, there is a tradition of throwing a baby tooth up into the sky to the sun or to Allah. This tradition may originate in a pre-Islamic offering and dates back to at least the 13th century. It is also mentioned by Ibn Hibbat al-Hadid in the 13th century.
So CE.
CE.
Yes. Yeah. So that's like the earliest mention of it is in writings by that person.
All right. So let's take a break for an ad. Check all of our teeth. Make sure they're still in there. Or maybe they're in your gun safe downstairs. Go check. And come back to talk about some traditional rites of passage.
Mm-hmm. We're back. And we're going to take a look at some rites of passage from around the world. Often cultures will have different types of ceremonies for male and female children. So we'll try to represent both groups here, though not always from the same culture, just trying to get an even mix. But let's talk generally first about how a rite of passage works to give some cultural and psychological context.
Rites of passage have three phases: separation, liminal, and incorporation. In the first phase, people withdraw from their current status and prepare to move from one place or status to another. The first phase of separation comprises symbolic behavior signifying the detachment of the individual or group from an earlier fixed point in the social structure. So there's often a detachment or cutting away from the former self in this phase, which is signified in symbolic actions and rituals. For example, the cutting of the hair for a person who has just joined the army. So they're cutting away the former self, the civilian. So it's a rite of passage. The transition, the liminal phase, is a period between states during which one has left one place or state but has not yet entered or joined the next, like the Britney Spears song. In the third phase, reaggregation or incorporation, the passage is completed through actions taken by the ritual subject. Having completed the rite and assumed their new identity, one re-enters society with one's new status. These rituals create feelings of affiliation and a sense of validity and acceptance for the individual and the group, respectively.
Yeah, so for the individual, it's like, now I've earned my place here in this new group. And then for the group, it's like, this person deserves to be here. They have done whatever needs to be done to join our group. So it's a way of sort of enhancing social cohesion. Mm-hmm. So now some examples, and we won't be able to touch on every possible example or this episode would be a week long. So I have just chosen a few. First up, the Satere Mawe are a tribe that lives in the Amazon rainforest of Brazil, and they believe that any boy who wants to become a man must experience the worst pain the jungle has to offer, the sting of Paraponera clavata, the bullet ant. The bullet ant is a species of ant with the most painful sting of any insect. True to its name, it supposedly has a sting that feels comparable to being shot with a bullet. Dr. Justin Schmidt, an entomologist and research director of the Southwest Biological Institute, invented, God bless him, the Schmidt Sting Pain Index, which categorizes the level of pain felt when stung by Hymenoptera, an order of insects that includes wasps, bees, and ants. The bullet ant ranks one of the two highest on his scale. It's one of the only two to score a 4. The pain of the bullet ant sting continues for up to 24 hours, receding and returning regularly. For their manhood ritual, the Mawe submerge hundreds of bullet ants in a natural sedative, rendering them unconscious. The large ants, while unconscious, are then woven into gloves made of leaves, with their stingers pointing towards the inside of the glove. When the ants regain consciousness, these gloves are then placed on the hands of young men undergoing the ritual.
They are mad when they regain consciousness.
I'm in a glove! Why? The boy must then keep the gloves on his hand for a full 5 minutes while the hundreds of ants repeatedly sting him. The bullet ant glove is then removed, but the boy will likely be in pain and shake uncontrollably for hours. He may even experience muscle paralysis, disorientation, and hallucinations. And this is just from the pain. This is like the body's reaction to the pain. There are, fortunately, at least according to the articles that I read, no long-term effects from the actual toxin in the sting. It's just the severe pain causes hallucinations and things like that. To fully complete this initiation and be accepted as a man by the tribe, the boys must endure this practice a total of 20 times over the course of months or even years. Wow. Moving from Brazil to Japan, Seijin no Hi, or Coming of Age Day, is one of the most important national holidays in Japan, not only due to the scale of preparation and publicity, but also because it's one of the most colorful and picturesque events throughout the year. The holiday, held on the second Monday of January, celebrates young people who have reached the age of 20 in the past year, Japan's official age of majority. It's a rite of passage and an opportunity for adults to remind future generations that maturity is not only about the ability to legally drive, consume alcohol, and vote. There are several theories regarding the holiday's origins, including some that date back as far as the 700s CE, when a young prince presented his clothes and hair as a sign of becoming an adult. However, the official holiday began in 1946 when a small city in Saitama, which is currently Warabi City, organized an event to give hope to younger generations after World War II. Other municipalities began to follow, and in 1948, Seijin no Hi was established as a national holiday to commemorate young adulthood and celebrate their journey to a new life on their own. Before officially bidding goodbye to their childhood, 20-year-olds registered in the area are invited by each municipality to a large ceremony at its local city hall. A series of lectures are conducted by established adults, key city hall figures for the most part, on what it means to be an adult and the responsibilities young people have for building the future. Participants are usually given small gifts and souvenirs of the event, and the ceremony is followed by parties and separate family events. The clothing worn is crucial for this holiday and involves much preparation, especially for the young ladies. Women usually wear furisode, a long-sleeved kimono worn by unmarried women. Hair salons and photo studios begin running campaigns months ahead of time. It's like prom, but
it's like adult prom, grown-up prom.
Offering hairstyling and special photo options to mark the event. Most young men would also wear traditional Japanese clothing, hakama, though increasingly now they turn to Western-style suits or other variations.
Wow. So,
yeah.
Staying in the environs of the Pacific, let's move on to Vanuatu. Every year, from April to June, the Vanuatuan island of Pentecost,
traditional Vanuatuan name,
Hosts one of the most spectacular and death-defying cultural ceremonies ever conceived.
I mean, you say it like that, but yeah, actually.
Known as the Nagol, it sees men climb flimsy 100-foot wooden towers and dive headfirst into empty space, with nothing to break their fall but vines tied to their ankles. So it's like, yep, base jumping? Is that base jumping?
Bungee. It's like bungee jumping, but okay, less springy. Base jumping, you have a floaty suit.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Like a flying squirrel type suit.
Okay.
Yeah. It's got like flaps.
A wingsuit?
That's the one. Flying squirrel suit.
Okay, so European missionaries banned land diving on Pentecost in the early 20th century, but the priests never reached the rugged southeast corner of the island where the ritual was passed on to successive generations. The ritual is said to have its roots in a legend about a dysfunctional marriage. As the story goes, a woman decided to flee into the jungle to escape daily confrontations with her spouse. Hotly pursued by her husband, she ran up a tree, then tied a vine around her ankle and jumped from the top, landing safely. The husband followed suit, but without the aid of the vine, he hit the ground with a fatal splat. Inspired by the woman's act of defiance, the women of Pentecost began land diving for fun. But uneasy was seeing the women dangling from trees in compromising positions. The island's men called an end to their fun and stole the activity for themselves. Over time, the land diving moved from trees to purpose-built towers. It's also been transformed into a ritual rife with religious symbolism. The success of the all-important yam harvest is said to depend on the courage of the previous year's divers. Diving is only permitted in the 2 months following the wet season to ensure the vines contain the water that lends them elasticity and strength.
And you don't want a dry vine.
Yeah. Adherence to religious customs is also considered essential to a diver's safety. While the tower is being constructed, the divers live together in men-only huts and avoid contact with women, a ritual said to clarify their minds. It probably won't surprise you to learn, listeners, that this festival inspired the sport of bungee jumping.
Yep.
The word bungee originates from the West Country dialect of the English language, meaning anything thick and squat.
Feeling a bit bungee today. It's good to know that.
I look like a bungee in these jeans. Next, we've got an example that takes place in multiple parts of Western and Central Africa on different occasions throughout a person's life, like at funerals, weddings, and when an infant reaches 4 months of age, or when a child reaches adolescence. So this is the Okuyi or Mikuyo. So our understanding here is that these are the names of two different characters or spiritual figures, and this can be traced back to Gabon.
Yeah, everything that I read, it was unclear whether the dance itself was called the Mikuyo, and then the character who does it is the Okuyi, or they're both characters, or they're interchangeable names for the same ritual. It was, I would love if someone would reach out and clarify that for us, because I wasn't able to find any definitive information.
The typical Okuyi performer wears a large loose costume that resembles the spirit of the clan member's ancestors. The ancestors are illustrated by the dancers as tranquil and serene. That's nice.
Mm-hmm.
That's nice. Mm-hmm. I want to think of my departed ancestors that way. Okuyi costumes are typically made from frills formed from the raffia palm, with an outfit underneath made of canvas or burlap. The thick textile forms the suit for the performer. Performers wear black socks made of cotton on their feet as well as on their hands. Every dancer carries through his presentation wearing a mask made of a soft local wood. The face masks on each performer is essential to identify each role in the performance, so the design has been kept constant since the 19th century.
That's when it's been, like, the earliest it was sort of recorded.
Okay.
So it may have been kept constant well before that. It's just,
Okay. The sign is a black chin and black forehead with white covering the cheeks and temples. Sometimes the dark red eyes remain closed as a sign that the person represented is dead. However, this contrasts with masks from Equatorial Guinea, as the face masks range from geometrical forms to human faces. The majority of the masks have the eyes closed and a few have them open. Some masks have a mirror attached to the forehead, which is used as a talisman. Women are the key voices of the chorus in the Mikuyo dances. The lyrics of the melodies the choir sings educate the listeners about everyday life possessions. Another common theme is the history of kinfolk, or events that have happened to important people of the community in the past. The songs are an important way to communicate historical knowledge. In a funereal context, the Mikuyo music and dance is used to break the mourning period and bring hope to all the mourners for the future. It's nice.
Yeah,
it's really nice.
Yeah, and this is like a type of ritual that is, that I think probably, I don't know, again, would love for someone to reach out to the dirtpodcast@gmail.com. But this is a ritual, or a type of ritual, that happens at lots of different life events. So I would presume that the type of thing that you do at a funeral is going to be slightly different from the type of thing you do to celebrate an infant turning 4 months old. But I don't know that for certain, but I think it's just sort of, and commemorating the ancestors, dancing, kind of strengthening bonds in the community, that sort of general act. A few others before we wrap up, just briefly. In Mali, Fulani women are ushered into womanhood by practicing chudi, or getting facial tattoos. The ritual has young girls getting their lip area tattooed with black as a sign of cultural identity and beauty. The idea is to look more attractive to a prospective husband. As the young girl endures the pain of being tattooed, women from the village gather around to watch, singing, clapping, chanting, and beating drums throughout the process. Sounds kind of fun and rowdy.
Yeah, keep those spirits up.
In Bali.
Mali to Bali.
From Mali to Bali.
Nope.
On the Mali Bali trolley.
Oh, golly.
Oh, golly. In Bali, Mepandes is a teeth filing ceremony that involves removing the sharp edges of canine teeth and filing the front six teeth flat to symbolically rid one of negativity, like lust, greed, anger, and jealousy. The procedure can only be performed on girls who've had their first period. Seems uncomfortable, but not making a cultural judgment, just thinking about my own teeth. In North Baffin Island, Inuit boys have traditionally gone out to the wilderness with their fathers between the ages of 11 and 12 to test their hunting skills and acclimatize to the harsh Arctic weather. And this is specifically people who follow a traditional lifestyle, because some people sort of move away from that, but some people still live traditionally. As part of that tradition, a shaman would be called to open the lines of communication between men and animals. Nowadays, this tradition has been extended to young girls as well, and out camps are established away from the community in order for traditional skills to be passed down and practiced by young men and women. That's just a whirlwind tour of some of these different coming of age ritual. So let's take one more quick ad break and then talk about an example from the archaeological record, since this is an archaeology show.
Well, hello there.
Welcome. Hi.
Back. Welcome back. As a final example of a rite of passage, we're looking at a 2001 article by Rosemary Joyce titled "Girling the Girl and Boying the Boy, the Production of Adulthood in Ancient Mesoamerica." And so this is from a section titled "The Existential Status of Aztec Children."
Do they exist?
Joyce writes, "The 16th century CE Nahuatl texts describe Aztec infants initially as raw materials that needed to be worked into specific forms."
Did you know that it used to be thought that bear mothers bears were born as sort of shapeless blobs of bear putty and the moms licked them into bear shape?
Well, that's the only way they could get that cute.
But also, if you've ever seen a newborn small mammal, it does look pretty shapeless.
Little lump of mammal putty.
Yeah, a little lump of mammal bean. Anyway.
Back to Rosemary Joy. "Life cycle rituals were the context where continued refinement of this raw material was effected. Before and at birth, the child was described as a precious product made by the gods."
I really like this. This is a quote from a codex. Quote? Yeah.
Okay. "The one who has arrived, the precious necklace, the precious feather, the baby, which has been flaked off here. Our Lord, the creator, the master, Quetzalcoatl, flakes a precious necklace, places a precious feather here on your neck, at your breast, in your hands. He places a precious necklace."
Isn't that nice?
Babies.
You just got a little baby around your neck. I mean, not like around your neck, but like, that's where they hold on to, you know?
So male babies were given items related to their expected role. Tiny shields, tiny bow and arrow, a little loincloth, and a baby cape. Female babies were given the equipment of women. The spinning whirl, the weaving sword. Not a weapon, the thing that you attach shuttle.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Good job.
Shuttle. The reed basket, the spinning bowl, the skeins, and her little skirt and shift. Aztec children went through various rituals of body modification throughout their childhoods, beginning with piercing their ears, which was typically a rowdy community festival with lots of food and drink. Not Claire's.
Not Claire's with a piercing gun.
With a gun, yeah. These piercings would often also be gradually gauged wider to accommodate adult earplugs. Sometimes this was done with a piercing through the lower lip as well.
Yeah, a librette.
The hair of Aztec youths also signaled their age or maturity. Up until around age 11, boys and girls had long locks of hair at the backs of their heads. For males, that lock was a symbol of his childhood and would be removed when he first took a captive in battle. After that point, another tuft was left to grow at the right side of his head, and that would get cut short to mark any further captives taken in battle.
It's like when you graduate and you change and you pull your tassel from one side to the other.
Women typically kept their hair long and bound around their heads in various styles that might indicate if a young woman was marriageable or if she had borne children. The article looks at depictions of Aztec youths in art and in descriptions of Spanish codices and in burials, and determines that especially with body modifications, there were some, like those large earplugs, that were specifically linked to adulthood. So in Aztec culture, it seems like there was almost a constant state of transition from childhood to adulthood, commemorated at various points by changes in appearance, which I'm sure many teens and former teens can relate to.
Mm-hmm. Phases. So listeners, there are tons of other examples of coming of age rituals out there. Bar and bat mitzvahs, quinceañeras, and confirmations are some that are explicitly linked to religion, as is Khatam al-Quran, a prestigious ritual celebrated by Malaysian girls once they reach the age of 11. The ceremony demonstrates their growing maturity at their local mosque. And girls spend years preparing for this day, reviewing the Quran, so they can recite the final chapter before friends and family. There's the Amish Rumspringa and Rus, the Norwegian equivalent, where teens are encouraged to go rage and sow their wild oats for a year before re-entering society as, one hopes, mature adults.
Yeah. So there are countless social categories and phases of life that humans move between, and it's really fascinating to think about how concepts are embodied in people, in objects, and in actions that we take. So with all of that to mull over, we'll wrap it up there, listeners.
Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back in your ears next week, like Aztec earplugs, with new content, which you can find on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you like to listen.
You can also find us over on social media, on Facebook, we're The Dirt Podcast, on Twitter, we're at Dirt Podcast, and on Instagram, we're at The Dirt Pod. And last week we shared cute photos of us as children.
Yep, we're really cute. And all of those feeds, plus our merch store and all our archived episodes and more are at thedirtpod.com. And truly, if you want to contact us, and ideally with constructive criticism about things that we've talked about and give us more detail, we would love to hear from you. And we would just love to hear from you in general. Say hi. Write messages. Yeah. Thanks, everybody. We love you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.